RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for our health hacks here at RCR Reality Check Radio. Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz, is back with us. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm looking forward to finding out why life expectancy has dipped. I'm really interested to hear about that because it's the first time I think I've heard that. It's always been, you know, we're living longer than our parents or generations before, but there's been a bit of a turn.
Yeah, so I came across this fascinating graph. It's predicting life expectancy, and it's started at 1900, and it's assuming that the improvement in life expectancy is linear. It's predicted that by the year 2110. So what's that? That's 90 years away, if I've done the maths correctly, is it?
Yeah,
we would be living to 110 years. But the prediction now is that our children on average will live less long than us. And that's the first time in recorded history that that's happened.
Why?
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a complex answer to that, and it will be multifactorial, but I would suggest it is the introduction of the food pyramid around 1980, with the introduction of all these ultra-processed foods and more sugar and these polyunsaturated vegetable oils. In combination with the other changes in our lifestyle, I think that they've all compounded. And yeah, now predicted that our children will not live as long as us. And that's disturbing.
It is, and unexpected. Though you might have been expecting it, were you?
Well, like you, I was shocked to see this graph, and equally, it's a prediction, and not yet a reality, but really something to wake us all up, isn't it? And as a society, do we have to do something about the influences that create this unhealthy environment?
All right. The heading of today's chat, practice tips and tricks, practicing low-carb lifestyle medicine. That's you.
Yeah. Isn't it? And it's my absolute interest has been in type 2 diabetes and really looking at the cause of type 2 diabetes. And we absolutely have an epidemic in type 2 diabetes. If you look at the American statistics, and they're winning, of course, but if you include diabetes and pre-diabetes, 49% of American adults now have pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes. We're not quite as bad in New Zealand. We're at 39%. But if you think in the United States, it's almost more likely that you will have diabetes or pre-diabetes than that you won't, you know, and it should be, if you go back a century, it was virtually never seen or heard of. The only diabetes that was around was the type 1 diabetes, which is what younger people tend to get, and it's when there's an autoimmune attack on the pancreas and the beta cells of the pancreas stop producing insulin. That's type 1 diabetes, very, very different from type 2 diabetes, which is now affecting almost half of American adults.
That is huge, isn't it? All I can see is endless rows of, machines cranking away.
Yeah.
Somewhere. I mean, endless opportunities for big pharma going along with it. That's the vision that comes to my mind.
And what's disturbing for me is that this is completely preventable and completely reversible. And I'm surprised that there's not much media on this topic. I'm surprised there's not conversation on this topic. I'm surprised that people aren't jumping up and down and protesting outside the main gates of these companies who are indirectly or directly responsible.
Pre-diabetes, is that how you describe it? And type 2. So how many of those pre will go on to develop the type 2, virtually all of them?
Yeah, no, great question. I think the conversion rate works out to something like 5% per year. So, you know, 5% of people with pre-diabetes per year will convert to diabetes. So, you know, I presume over 20 years, you would expect the majority of those people to become diabetic, unless they make some changes to turn it all around. The other thing I'd like to bring up is I hate the term pre-diabetes. You know, it implies, it's a bit like an orange traffic light, isn't it? You know, you don't really have to take any notice of it until it turns red. It's like, well, you are supposed to actually take notice of the orange light, and you are actually supposed to stop on an orange light. This pre-diabetes concept, my very good friend, Professor Grant Schofield, uses the term. He says pre-diabetes is pre-nothing. You know, by the time you have pre-diabetes, you have 10 years of severe metabolic dysfunction, and it's not actually pre-anything. And I would like to get rid of this whole terminology and call it all diabetes, or even better, call it insulin resistance, because insulin resistance is what happens 10 years before you develop pre-diabetes. By the time you have pre-diabetes, your pancreas is now unable to produce enough insulin to keep up with needs. It's effectively a relative organ failure. You know, and organ failure sounds pretty bad, isn't it? You know, that conjures up this idea of the machines you were talking about. You know, organ failure, you think about organ transplants and dialysis machines and stuff. You know, we're going pre-diabetes. Oh, you don't actually have to do anything yet. I'd like to change the imagery, change the way that doctors particularly are thinking about pre-diabetes, call it insulin resistance, and diagnose it even 10 years before the pancreas is unable to keep up. Then I think we would do something about it. We need to be measuring insulin and another blood test called C-peptide. So for the listeners, C-peptide and insulin aren't done very often, but they are absolutely available at community laboratories on a lab form from your doctor. I would ask for that. I'd be doing that as part of my annual wellness check. I would like to be picking up these early insulin resistance and doing something about it 10 years even before it becomes pre-diabetes. I actually know that, you know, in some situations, nothing is done even about the pre-diabetes until it gets to diabetes. You know, way, way, way too late. Let's deal with it at the insulin resistance stage, but even better, let's deal with it one stage before that. Let's deal with it more at a community or legislative level, where we actually stop allowing the companies to sell and advertise. You know, I'm sort of having to think about my words as I speak, because I know that there's negatives in terms of regulation. But, you know, should we be allowing these companies this absolute unrestricted access to advertising to children, to producing these foods which are clearly poison? You know, there's got to be a level. You know, you're not allowed to poison people deliberately, are you? I mean, I think it's reasonable that there's legislation around not being allowed to do that. This is akin to it, but there's no restriction at all. I don't know how that restriction should look, but I don't think the food companies should be allowed, at a minimum, to advertise their products to children.
Next logical question from me, because I remember you telling me that with reversalnz.co.nz, or reversalnz, that's the website, obviously, that you'd fixed over 100 people. You've got 100, over 100, I can't remember the exact, maybe 120 figure, where you can show that type 2 diabetes has been reversed kind of back to normal. You'd think that would be, there'd be major curiosity in that, you know? I mean, that's quite stunning when you think about it, but there doesn't seem to have been. That's what I'm reckoning.
No, you're right. You're right, Paul, because until probably about 6 to 8 years ago, I thought that type 2 diabetes was this chronic, untreatable, unrelenting progression to organ failure, to blindness, to dialysis, to limb amputations, to insulin injections. And I thought it was just chronic and unrelenting. And we just supported people on this journey and started the medicines as we went. And then probably 8 years ago, I went to a series of lectures, one after another. It was Professor Grant Schofield saying that you can reverse diabetes with diet. It was a bariatric surgeon saying you can reverse diabetes with bariatric surgery. There was an amazing paper called the DIRECT trial that came out in December 2017, and it showed that with a calorie-restricted diet, you could reverse diabetes. And I went, "Wow, I'm into this. I'm going to work out how to do this." And yeah, as you mentioned, when I was working at the Taupo Medical Center, we had an excess of 150 people that had reversed their diabetes or pre-diabetes. I've just been actually reviewing the statistics over the weekend for reversal. We've had 46 people who have reversed their diabetes and pre-diabetes in our reversal lifestyle medicine clinic. But the additional piece of information that I've got from that is I've been able to look at the numbers needed to treat. So how many people have started on this program and how many people have done it. And it's 25% of the people that have started on the program have at this stage reversed their diabetes or pre-diabetes. I anticipate that it'll end up at about every second person, so numbers needed to treat of two, because that's the figures that Dr. David Unwin in the UK, who's been doing this much longer than me, he's got numbers in his general practice of numbers needed to treat of two, which means that every second person reverses their diabetes. I anticipate with a little bit more time, we will see those figures, or I hope even better, because I'd love to beat them. That every second person is able to reverse their diabetes or pre-diabetes, but that's a little bit misleading, because virtually every one of them will reverse their, also improve their HbA1c. They will improve things, even if they don't all get to the point of complete reversal. You know, so everyone is improving, everyone's getting better with this lifestyle intervention. So it begs the question, why are the majority of health centres using medications when I've never seen, or very, very infrequently seen, somebody reverse their diabetes with medication? Why isn't everyone using a nutritional or lifestyle approach to reversing diabetes?
Yeah, if there was a 25% improvement in cancer rates, well, going down, not going up, I mean, they'd be crowing it from the rooftops, wouldn't they? Big time.
If this was only about people's health and wellness, or even if it was only about the absence of disease, you're exactly right. Logic says that, wow, medicine will be jumping up and down about this and studying it, and I would have all sorts of health department officials asking, how are you doing this? What's going on? So why is that not happening? Why is there an absolute lack of interest in this approach? I've got a few ideas of why that might be. One of them is that doctors currently are working predominantly in a pharmaceutical model. You know, it's the pharmaceutical model that's taught in medical schools, the pharmaceutical approach which you learn in your training, and the pharmaceutical approach that you do every day. Anything that is outside of that is treated with suspicion. So, you know, the pharmaceutical
industry, even if you can show the stats, though, Glenn, like, here it is, I can show you, here are the people, I'll bring them along, they'll tell you.
Yeah, and it takes time to influence in that way. And I've recently spoken at a general practice conference, and I've been doing that for the last 6 years. And I certainly notice that there is an increasing amount of interest each year that I speak, which is really interesting. But it's not like there are people sitting on the floor of the lecture theatre where I'm speaking. You know, sometimes the seats are all full, but it's not overbooked and people you know, banging down the door to get in, which logic would suggest there should be. Perhaps it's my presentation style, maybe, Paul. Maybe do you think I need to get a little bit more excited and animated? Maybe there's too many statistics and graphs.
Throw your arms around.
Yeah.
You mentioned Dr. David Unwin before. I think you mentioned him in previous health hacks. And I was just thinking, you know, what does it take for people to get it? And I think he's come up with a sugar analogy, hasn't he, that kind of really simplifies it and sort of hits you like a sledgehammer, potentially. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so Dr. David Unwin is a gentleman GP in the UK. I think he's been doing this for around 15 years, and he probably single-handedly has changed the way that type 2 diabetes is managed in the NHS, the UK medical system. And he's got this amazing infographic. So he says that one serving of rice is equivalent to 10 teaspoons of sugar. And he's got a picture of the number of teaspoons of sugar. Now, you should only have 4 grams, less than a teaspoon of sugar in your blood at any one time. So 10 teaspoons of sugar just from a serving of rice is an awful lot. One banana, 5.7 teaspoons of sugar, and one piece of bread is 3 times the amount of sugar that you should have in your body at any one time. You know, so putting it in that pictorial form, it's like a light bulb moment for most people. And that's where they get the fact that it's not just the sugar you have to remove from your diet. It's the other carbohydrates that you have to minimize if you have diabetes, prediabetes, or insulin resistance.
Where is medicine on dietary fats?
Yeah, and great topic that you've brought up, because I think that's the elephant in the room. That's what causes most doctors to shudder at the thought of a diet which is low in carbohydrate, moderate in protein, with a higher intake of fats. That's where they shudder, because there is this belief within medicine that eating saturated fat and cholesterol-containing foods in particular will result in an increase in LDL cholesterol, which will lead to heart attacks and strokes. However, it has been proven over and over and over again that eating saturated fat and cholesterol-containing foods does not increase your risk of heart disease. You cannot put a group of rats or monkeys or humans on a high saturated fat diet and cause atherosclerosis. It just doesn't happen. However hard the proponents of this diet heart hypothesis have tried, you just can't do it. And there's all sorts of science, which I've recently been talking about at this conference, that proves that that's not the case. And interestingly, some boxes that have been found hidden away in people's attics, which from sort of 40 to 50 years ago, which didn't support the idea that eating saturated fat caused heart disease. They were buried and sort of found by somebody's grandchildren in the attic 50 years later and then published, which would have been embarrassing for those people if they were still alive, but fortunately they're not.
I remember talking to one of my relatives, and my grandfather died young. He had a major heart attack on the golf course, as it turned out. And I remember her saying, well, it was because he had bacon and eggs for breakfast for most of his life. And I always thought, well, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Just a curious question. Would that have been it? Because eggs are good. Probably had a bit of toast and butter. And bacon, well, back in the day, we're talking 50, 60 years ago now. Would there have been something in that?
No, I think we've disproven the bacon and eggs as the cause of heart disease theory. I would expect in the period of time that you're talking about, it would have been cigarette smoking, because you know, when you watch the movies from those days, it's like everyone chain smoked. I reckon it was the cigarette smoking, and I'm assuming that he smoked.
I'm not too sure. I'd have to check up on that.
Yeah,
I reckon. But he went at 60, which is my age.
Yeah, I think it's the smoking was the big issue back then. Now it's actually eating carbohydrate-containing foods. That becomes blood glucose. The blood glucose goes to the liver and it gets turned into fat. It's that fat that ends up in LDL or bad cholesterol, and that's the fat that can potentially cause heart disease. So the process is called de novo lipogenesis. Novo meaning new, as in nouveau riche. Lipo meaning lipid, meaning fat, and genesis to make, the making of new fat. And you make new fat from carbohydrate. And when you analyze the LDL molecules and you analyze the atherogenic plaques, they contain even chain fatty acids. So just to sort of say what I mean by that, if you can picture way back in your biochemistry days, if you can't think back that far, Paul, but a fatty acid's got a glycerol backbone, and then it has these three tails, and those tails are made up of carbon molecules linked together, and they will be, you know, 8 long or 12 long or 18 carbons joined together. The even ones, they come from de novo lipogenesis, and they're the ones that we find inside LDL. The odd ones, and, you know, odd and even ones come from the diet, but when you see how much, the odd ones only come from the diet. When you look inside the LDL particle, only 0.5% are odd chain. So to me, that's absolutely convincing evidence that it's the fat that we are making from carbohydrate that is the problem, not the fat that we're eating.
Okay, well, that's a hard one to change the thinking on, because there's been serious onslaught of messaging over many decades to the contrary, you know, that.
Yeah, and you're bringing up a really interesting point. How long does it take between the first scientific paper which proves something and for it to become part of mainstream medicine? And I love to tell you this wonderful story of Semmelweis. So he lived in Austria, if I'm recalling correctly. Someone correct me if I've chosen the wrong Eastern European country. But and he proved that if you washed your hands between doing an autopsy and then doing a vaginal examination on a woman in labour, that you would significantly reduce the amount of puerperal sepsis, which was a woman dying from infection in childbirth. And he proposed that there was something that was transferred on the hands from the cadaver to the live woman. Now that we understand bacteria, it's pretty damn obvious that that's what was happening. But this was before they understood bacteria. But he proposed something was transferred from the corpse to the pregnant woman. And he proposed that washing the hands would prevent that. And he started washing his hands, and his statistics dropped down dramatically lower than his colleagues. He wrote this up properly. He did it all properly. And it was 50 years between when he proved that to when it became a requirement to wash your hands between doing an autopsy and examining women in labor. You know, nowadays when we hear that, we're going, oh, duh, how stupid were they? But 50 years, where it should have happened immediately that he proved it. But what happened is it was a badge of honor to have gore on your apron. The more blood and gore you had on your apron and hands, the more mana you had in that
How weird is that?
Yeah, it was a show of authority. And so the resistance was, I will lose status and mana if I wash all the gore off from the autopsy room off my apron. And it gets even worse when you look at vitamin C. So scurvy. So in the old days, a large percentage of the sailors died from scurvy. I think it was over 25% died from scurvy on each journey. And they proved that if you took limes with you, that's actually why the English were called limeys.
Oh.
Because eventually, 200 years after it was first demonstrated, 200 years later, the British Navy required citrus to be taken on all British ships. So the fact that they carried limes was why they were called limeys. Yeah, 200 years. So somewhere between 50 and 200 years for something to be proved, for it to actually become commonplace. And the reason that I'm banging on about this stuff all the time, virtually every week that that you have me on the show, is I don't want it to take 50 years, because I'm thinking of all the hardship, all of the injury, all of the cost, all of the families disrupted and people being unable to work. That is entirely preventable. And all we have to do is we have to change our diets and get rid of the ultra-processed carbohydrates and get rid of the sugar. And also we probably need to be doing something at a government level. It could be as simple as reducing the sugar content of soft drinks. I would love to see further discussion about a sugar tax. I would love to
see... Do you think that can work, Glenn? Because people say it can't work.
Yeah, I've heard people say that it can't. My understanding, and I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the outcomes in detail. I'm sort of only thinking conceptually. But I think it's been demonstrated in Mexico to work, but I'll need to look at that argument in a bit more detail.
Yeah. Interesting what you said about the gore on the apron being kind of a status symbol, a symbol of mana. Do you think we've still got the same mindset? Resistance, to use that word, to change is not about the facts necessarily. It's about maintaining a culture, a status within a culture, whatever you want to call it, that it's kind of the human condition in a way. And I think we've seen evidence of, well, maybe the word is arrogance, of that kind of arrogance recently, where no one can ever be wrong, you know, can't even think about being wrong. And as you pointed out, it catches up eventually. But in the meantime, there's all this collateral damage. Are we living with the same sort of mindset, but all this time later, do you think?
Yeah, everything that you've said is true. And it's really hard to be wrong, but it's particularly hard to be wrong if you've based your theory and your academic status on a subject. One of the people I admire the most is Professor Tim Noakes from South Africa. Have you come across him, Paul?
I've heard him being mentioned, and I do know someone with a surname Noakes from South Africa, so he's probably related, but I don't know the individual, but I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, so Professor Noakes was the father of carb loading, and he developed diabetes while training for the Conyers Ultra Marathon, and he sort of went, wow, something's really, really gone wrong here. You know, what's gone wrong? And he became a absolute proponent of the low-carb approach, particularly in endurance athletes. And he said, I was wrong, but not only was I wrong, I was completely 100% wrong. And he then started talking about the opposite. I have huge admiration for him, because it's hard to say I was wrong. It's hard to say I was completely wrong, but it's particularly hard to say you're wrong if your whole, you know, everything that you've talked about is around that topic. Huge admiration for him. Interestingly, he was subsequently taken to the disciplinary board of South Africa by a dietitian for giving low carb advice. But there's a little tip. If you're going to take somebody on legally, don't take on an A-grade professor. To be an A-grade professor, you have to be in the top 5% of professors in your country, which implies that you're good at research. So there was a three-year court case where apparently he sat down with a pile of papers that was, sort of, I think, half a meter deep, and he started at the top. And he peeled the papers off as he read through the entire list. You know, so wouldn't you hate that if you'd sort of quickly typed out a complaint email one morning before work and it resulted in 3 years in court? And he, of course, was vindicated. But, yeah, that's a cool story.
Yeah. I'm also thinking those 150 people that have had their type 2 diabetes reversed by your intervention, help, whatever you want to call it, that must give them a liberation. That would blow me away if I had been cured of that.
Yes.
What's their reaction?
Yeah, they're absolutely thrilled. And what's cool is almost universally they feel so much better. You know, there's less brain fog, there's more energy. All of those abdominal bloating and all that sort of stuff that we consider to be normal, it all goes away. And they feel wonderful. And they can become quite evangelical, similar to the reformed smoker. So yeah. I spend quite a lot of time saying to people that, you know, only bring up the topic, but please don't ear bash anyone unless they're interested. You know, ask first, do you want to hear this information? Because we certainly know that ear bashing someone about smoking or diet doesn't really work.
Yeah, they've got to sort of come to it on their, well, sort of on their own, by themselves, maybe.
Well, if they're inquisitive and asking questions, then launch. But if they look completely disinterested and they're going, oh, you mean I'll have to give up my bread, I'm out of here. It's quite interesting, the particular food that people are least likely to give up. I think it depends in which country you were born. If you were born in New Zealand, it's almost universally bread. You know, when I say you got to stop bread, that's when about half the audience leave. If someone's grown up in India or Sri Lanka, it's when I say you're going to have to give up rice. That's when the other half leave.
Not many left.
Yeah. So, you know, it's dependent a little bit on your cultural or ethnic heritage.
Coming up against time, I'm sure there's plenty more that can be said. And some of this we've already talked about in previous chats over the year and, well, nearly a half that we've been going here at RCR. Anything else you want to say? You know, bring the hammer down.
Bring the hammer down, all right.
This is your opportunity to really drive the point. Here we go, if you haven't already.
I think that when we talk about this low-carbohydrate, healthy-fat diet or keto, people get the bit, I have to lower the carbs. They all get that all sugar, all carbohydrates becomes blood sugar and sugar becomes fat. I've got to get rid of the sugar and I've got to reduce my carbs. They all get that. But what people struggle with is the increasing the dietary fat, increasing the healthy fat component of it, because we don't want people to become calorie restricted. So if you've reduced the carbs, you can feel free to increase your healthy fat intake. So more avocado, more olive oil. You can eat fattier cuts of meat. You know, so it is a low carbohydrate, moderate protein, higher fat diet. And just I will finish on one point. A meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials where they've gone from 60% carbohydrate in the diet through a whole lot of different percentages down to 10%. And they've looked at how the HbA1c or the diabetes measure corresponds. There is an absolutely linear relationship between improvement in diabetes and the reduction in carbohydrate, and it's completely linear. You know, and to me, that is such a strong and irrefutable indication that lowering the carbohydrate is the key to reversing type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, insulin resistance, or whatever other name we call it.
All right, reversalnz.co.nz. If people want to know more, they can go there. Can they contact you folks through there?
Absolutely.
And what, organize a consultation? Is that what they do?
Yeah. Just get in contact because there's me there. But we've got all sorts of health coaches that and nutritionists and psychologists that can help with every aspect of dietary change.
And if we get any incoming texts or emails regarding that, we'll forward them to you, Glenn. Thanks for coming on again. Really interesting as always. And great work that you're doing. Well done.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you for letting me, you know, make this more known about in the community.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.